Okay, so it's really interesting. Paramabandhu, my co-author, he walks around with his iPad and has got this app called Simple Minds where you can kind of make little notes, and I thought, oh, that's a really good idea, and I started doing it on the train, and I just thought, oh, forget it, I'll just go back to my pieces of paper. I do own an iPad, but I don't know, I like the feel of a paper, but maybe actually I'm deluded because it's trees, isn't it? So yeah, one has to think about that. Addicted to books. Anybody here addicted to books? Okay, so how the book came about. Every time I actually speak to that, it's something different comes out of my mouth, so I'm not quite sure what will come out of my mouth, but it's my truth for today, how the book came about. I think what I will say is that I had this kind of feeling about 6 months or a year ago thinking, oh my God, I've come out about being in recovery on Facebook, because we have a Facebook page, and it's like, I hadn't really thought about it at the time. It seemed a really good idea to have a Facebook page, and then, of course, you start talking about recovery and stuff like that, you come out about it. And it's really interesting because, you know, I've had a lot of support with my friends, but it was interesting when the book was published, and this year, last month, January, and I put, woohoo, the book is out on the streets in England. And, you know, I had about 6 comments. Normally, I get about 50, 60, you know, that's like my average. Had 5 or 6 comments, and it was so interesting. So obviously, the majority of the people I know weren't as delighted as I was about the book coming out. And it's quite interesting coming out about it, because I've never identified as somebody being in recovery or as somebody having an addiction. And I'm really pleased with that, actually. Yeah, I am, because, you know, otherwise it would just be another identity that I would have had to have got rid of. But how did I come about to write this book? I suppose by walking through the center, by walking through the doors of a Buddhist center, actually. I walked through the doors of a Buddhist center 23 years ago. It was about 23 years ago. And actually my first experience of meditation was transcendental meditation. So that was it. And the thing is, you know, when you've got friends, you know, who meditate, why is it that we don't want to go to where they go? We have to find our own way. You know that? So I was actually surrounded by people who meditated. In fact, you know, I had friends who would go off and do retreats, and we would laugh and say, oh, that's what the good girls do. They go off and do retreats, and we're the bad ones, because I was off partying. So now I'm a good girl, well, semi-good girl. And so, you know, the offer of meditation was always there for me. But as I said, I started transcendental meditation, and it was fantastic. But the teacher left and went to India. And so what was I going to do? So I thought, okay, all right then. I'll go along to the London Buddhist Center, because I knew people who went there. And I think, in a way, that's been my journey into writing this book. When I walked through the center, when I walked through the doors of a Buddhist center, what I was carrying with me was my addiction of bulimia, anorexia nervosa. I was an extreme bulimic, and I would have been purging up to 40, 50 times a day. And that's when I was recording it, okay? And to give myself respite, I would take cocaine or go clubbing. That's what I did, and that's how I managed it. And, you know, I had different therapies and nothing seemed to be working. And I was lucky if I had 1 or 2 days kind of abstinence and sobriety. But I started meditating, I went on retreats, and all of a sudden I could have a weekend with eating food, holding on to it and not throwing it up. And also I could experience, even if what I called overeating, I could hold on to it and not feel that I had to throw it up. And then I would go on retreats for a week and I would have this abstinence and sobriety. And when I came off the retreats, something different happened and I would relapse. So in a way, I just knew that I had found something which could really help me with my disease. And, you know, I suppose in a way, meditation was my therapy initially. I used it as my therapy. Some people say, oh, these people who call meditation and Buddhism therapy, we're bad people. And I say, well, I'm one of those people, and actually I don't see what's wrong with it. It actually cleaned me up. That's how I used it. That, you know, if that's a way in for people, that's fantastic. Basically, Buddhism became something different later on, but initially that's what it was for me. And it was the teachings. I remember very early on hearing the core teachings of the Four Noble Truths. And I remember hearing that there was suffering. And it was almost like the world opened up to me, that actually I wasn't on my own anymore and somebody understood me, because I knew what suffering was. I knew what suffering was because of my childhood, and I knew what suffering was because of my disease. And so it was just great to just have that, a teaching to tell me that there was suffering. And that second teaching, craving, but for me it wasn't the craving which really kind of hit me in the heart. It was that thing of that there was a path that led to more suffering. And I knew very clearly I was on that path that led me to more suffering. I knew that the way I was living my life, the way that I was trying to manage my life, was just creating more suffering. I knew that. But I didn't know how to get off the wheel of that suffering, but I knew that's what I was doing. And then, it's really interesting, the third one, the cessation of suffering. I couldn't understand why that was the third truth. I couldn't understand why that was the third truth, and why wasn't it the fourth truth? Why wasn't the third one that there was a path that would take us away, and the fourth one was that there was a cessation of suffering? And I realized that actually, if it had been the other way round, I wouldn't have had hope. That third truth gave me hope. That there could be an end to suffering. If you told me that there was a path that led me away first, I wouldn't have believed you. I wouldn't have believed you, and I wouldn't have wanted to step onto it. But the fact that it was the third suffering, the fact that it was the third truth that told me that there was an end of suffering, just gave me hope. And then that there was a path that could take me away, I wanted to know what that path was. And so in a way, that was, you know, my beginning of just exploring my own addictions. You know, I was one of these people where you would meet me and I would give you all the talk and I would tell you, this is what you needed to do, you know, and this is what you needed to do to clean up, this is what you needed to do to sort your life out. And people would go away and do it and I would still be there with my disease. One day I woke up and I thought, hold on a minute, what's going on here? All these people are going away with my teachings and I'm still in exactly the same place. So I really got to a place in my practice where I wanted to bring my walk and my talk closer together. And I say that's what my spiritual practice is about, really working at really bringing my walk and my talk closer together. And the Buddhist teachings really gave me a way out of my suffering. You know, I spent so long doing the Metta Bhavana. I loved the practice of the Metta Bhavana. In fact, I remember after a month of doing the Metta Bhavana, I remember thinking the world was changing, but what was happening was I was changing. That's just the impact that it had on me. And I spent several years putting myself in every stage because that's what I needed to do. Forget about the rest. I just knew intuitively I needed to put myself in every stage of that. And it's a practice that I continue to do, practice of loving kindness. Because when I walked through the doors of a Buddhist center, the mantra that I had in my head was, I hate myself, I hate myself. And I said it 10 to a dozen. I can remember leaving the London Buddhist Center, standing on the platform at Bethnal Green Station and being shocked at that voice, I hate myself, I hate myself. Because I'd started to slow down and I started to really hear the noise and the clutter in my head. So, fast forwarding, during all of that, I've been a writer. I've written, this is my 8th book. So, you know, on some levels, you know, people would see me successful. I had a very successful career. I won't go into that. But what happened was is I moved to Vancouver and I started an evening at Vancouver Buddhist Center called Recovery Mondays. And this was an evening for anybody who saw themselves in recovery from anything. And it's been our busiest and fastest growing evening. And, you know, what we're doing is looking at recovery through the lens of the Dharma, or looking at the Dharma through the lens of recovery. And so, you know, I do teach Dharma there. And one of the teachings we were exploring 2 or 3 years ago was the teachings on the four reminders, and I was focusing on the precious birth. And although I was very familiar with these teachings and I'd heard them many times, it was just this particular time which made me think, well, why is my birth precious? You know, I know on an intellectual level, my birth is precious because, as we know, many eggs don't survive in a fetus. So it's a miracle that all of us here are sitting in this room. But that wasn't enough. I needed to understand it on an experiential level. And as my teacher says, Sangharakshita, that, you know, you can know it all on an intellectual level, but it isn't until you know it on an emotional level that really it, something is happening. It makes sense that actually you're then beginning to really understand the Dharma. And so I reflected on it, and because I was struggling with it so much, I decided to ask myself the question, well, if my birth is precious, why do I want to live? And every answer that I had was ego-based. In the sense, it was all about my identity or the good things that I needed to do in the world or the things that I hadn't done. So I flipped it around and said, well, if my birth is precious, why don't I want to die? And still, the same answers came up. They were just ego-based, all around identity. And it wasn't good enough for me. I wasn't satisfied, but what could I do? I couldn't answer this question. So I just thought, well, I'll just let it ruminate. And a few months later, this voice said, what you have to offer is your recovery. And it was like, oh, excuse me? What I have is to offer is my recovery. What do you mean? And I knew what it meant. You know, in fact, many people have asked me, what was it about you that you survived, you know? And I, when people used to ask me that, I used to push it away. I'm like, because of, well, what are you asking me that for? But actually, when I look at it and I think, yeah, you know, actually, it is a miracle that I'm standing here. It's a miracle that I'm actually standing here, and the strongest drug that I take is arnica. That is a miracle. Because, you know, the people who I've travelled with from the moment I was born, some of them took their own lives, some of them have died through accidental drug overdose, some of them are mentally and emotionally stunted, some of them live on sleeping pills, Prozac, and there are a few of us who could actually say that the strongest pill they take is arnica. And that's through my practice of the Dharma, through the practice of meditation. And so when this voice said, you know, what I have to offer is my recovery, it was like, oh, does that mean that my work has to change? You know, because I've written about an eclectic amount of subjects. And it was like, no, it wasn't that my work had to change, but in a way there needed to be a slight shift. But it was also scary to think that actually, okay, what I have to offer is my recovery. But on another level, it was just really quite humbling in the sense of actually, this is me wanting to step into the Buddha's steps in the sense of just being the vessel to help impart some of the Buddha's teachings, some of Shakyamuni's teachings, because the teachings in these books aren't my teachings. I'm just the vessel for those teachings, and hopefully to try and make those teachings accessible to other people out there. So it was then, so I had that awareness. Then a couple of months later, Windhorse was writing to their author saying, is there another book that you want to write? So there it was. Okay, a book on recovery, a book looking at the Buddhist teachings on recovery. And for me, it was really important because, you know, I've met people who have been in other programs and it hasn't worked for them and they have felt doomed. And I've met people who have felt like 12 steps is the only way. And in a way, that denies my experience because I cleaned up in the meditation rooms, I cleaned up in the Dharma halls. And I think 12 steps is absolutely brilliant. In fact, I encourage people to go along to meetings, to go along to 12-step meetings, but it doesn't work for everybody. And I wanted to be able to share something that had completely transformed my life. So when I put my proposal together and spoke to Windhorse Priyananda, who is Windhorse, and I was speaking about the book and I was saying, oh, Paramabandhu, I said, he would be one of my readers. And Priyananda said, have you thought about asking Paramabandhu to co-write with you? And in that moment, it was like, ding, that's a very good idea. You know, I'd never worked with Paramabandhu, although our paths had crossed because of the excellent work that he's been doing at London Buddhist Centre in Breathing Space. Breathing Space has been going for over 10 years now, and it has just brought a whole new audience to the Dharma. You know, the people who walk through the doors of the Breathing Space would perhaps never have gone to a Buddhist center. And in the Breathing Space, it's all the teachings on mindfulness base for stress, mindfulness base for depression, mindfulness base for addiction. So talking about Paramabandhu and his route in, Paramabandhu works for the National Health Service, and he is a clinical psychiatrist specializing in addictions. And he came along to the Buddhist centers around 25 years ago too, so around a similar time. And he was a medical student and he was very interested in the mind, wasn't sure what he wanted to be doing, but knew that he didn't want to be a doctor, and so specialized in psychiatry. And then it's actually just, well, is anything accident? But by accident, he ended up doing work in the addictions field and thought, I like this. This is working with suffering. This actually relates to my practice as a Buddhist. And then about 20 years ago, him and another order member wrote a paper on looking at the effects of mindfulness and recovery, the effects of mindfulness and addiction. So wrote this paper and then did nothing about it. 10 years later, you see mindfulness really starts to begin booming. I mean, I always say, you know, soon we're going to have mindfulness approaches for sex. Watch out for it. I'm not going to write it, but, you know, it's got to come. It has to come. So what's really interesting for Paramabandhu is they did nothing about it. And he, 11 years later, he goes to a conference where Ian Marlett, the late Ian Marlett, is talking. And he quotes Dr. Paramabandhu Groves about mindfulness, and he's thinking, oh, did I say that? Did I write that? And had to go back and look up the paper to see what he had written. So, you know, for him, he was always aware of the good things that mindfulness could do for people in addiction and recovery. So basically, he was the chairman of London Buddhist Centre, and he was seeing that people were really beginning to get excited about mindfulness, was at a council meeting and said one day, I really think that the Buddhist Centre should start doing stuff around mindfulness and addiction, mindfulness and depression. And he says, everybody looked at him and he was looking behind. And he realized in that moment, actually, he was the person who needed to take the lead in that, really. And so hence the breathing space. And so we, and in a way, the breathing space is where we actually connected as two professionals. When I was moving to Vancouver or to Canada, I was just curious to see what he was doing around mindfulness and addiction. And I sat in on a couple of his sessions. And I said to him, I said, I've been doing that in my work. Just, you know, the same models, because there's a whole load of cognitive-based therapy models that you use. And I'd just been using them for situations of conflict transformation. So it was like, oh, wow. So he said, okay, well, why don't you go away and deliver it? So we had this communication through email, and he was very supportive, and I started delivering it in Vancouver. But I should say that actually about 10 or 11 years ago, I was actually one of the trainers from Clean Break, Clean Break got the contract to deliver the anger management package to women who were sent to rehab instead of prison. They had a choice to either go to prison or rehab because the crimes they had done had been done under the influence of alcohol or drugs. And it was very interesting for me, actually, because we co-trained. And I can remember we were at this part of the course where we're really looking at abstinence, letting go. And I can remember my co-trainer standing in the doorway, smoking a cigarette. And I used to be a smoker. You see, I've still got that hand movement, you know, smoking a cigarette. And it was in that moment I just thought, God, we're no different from then, are we? We're no different. And it just made me think, do I think it's possible to let go of alcohol? I wasn't an alcoholic. Yes, I drank. As we say, I drank. I was a social drinker, but alcohol wasn't my thing. But, you know, I just thought, is it really possible? Here I am trying to enable these women to let go of alcohol, but yet, you know, I'm still drinking. Do I think it's possible? So I had an experiment. I decided to try for a year. I did it for a year, and then about 18 months later, I had a drink, and then I just thought, oh, no, you know, it's like actually doing that work just, you know, I think it maybe resonated with my Buddhist practice as well. As we said today, I undertake to abstain from taking intoxicants, and they're principles to train the mind. So in a way, I hate to destroy the delusion, but that those principles really are actually saying that the ideal is that we let go of intoxicants, not that it's okay that we continue them. So it's not giving yourself a hard time if you still do it, but actually this is where we're at, but we're undertaking to abstain, so at some point we will let go. So I think, you know, doing that training, having my Buddhist practice, really made me just, well, look at the precepts in a different way. I mean, I would say that the precepts for me was key in my recovery, was absolutely key. I remember becoming a mitra, so you become a mitra and you take the five precepts. And I remember one day coming off retreat thinking, oh, I'm going to, I remember thinking, oh, I'm going to practice these precepts daily. And after a couple of months, I remember thinking, oh, this is all fine and dandy, doing all the positive ones, you know, with deeds and loving kindness, I'll purify my body and, you know, and everything else. But what about the negative ones? Are they missing? And so I thought, let me start saying the negative ones in English too. And something changed. I can't put it into words what it was that changed. But what I know is that I began to experience my unskillful behaviours differently. And, you know, I began to, even the pleasure of taking intoxicants was experienced differently. So it was key to my recovery. And as we know, people who do have addictions, their ethical life is out of sync. There's something going on which is unethical. And it's also said that, you know, if we're people who dwell in negative mental states and go in and out of negative mental states or have a spate of being in negative mental states, take a look at what's going on in your ethical life. Because, you know, it's coming back to that first one, harming life. And we can harm ourselves, and that's harming life. And we can harm ourselves with our stinking thinking, let alone all the other things that we can harm ourselves with. So really, it's one of the key things in the book. I'm looking at the time and I can't believe it, because you've got to buy books. I'll never be forgiven if they're left with all these books and I've got to sign them too. So I'll tell you what the steps are and then you can ask me a question. Hadn't planned that, so it'd be kind of interesting to hear what I said. Didn't say that? So the steps, well, what I will say really quickly is how we came to call it 8 steps. We inherited 8 steps because initially, as everybody thinks, oh, it's going to be the Noble Eightfold Path. And we really try to package the book around the Noble Eightfold Path, but it just wasn't happening. We wrote our first draft and it was just like, this isn't happening. And that's great, you write your first draft and it's like, we have to throw this out. But we inherited 8 stages. And calling it, we called it, it was interesting because first of all, it was like, well, you know, we don't want it to conflict with 12 steps and, you know, but if you know Buddhism, Buddhism is full of lists. So we've given you another list to learn. But also, one of the important texts in Buddhism is the Dhammapada. And the epitomology of Pada is steps. Steps of the Dharma. And so now, in more contemporary times, verses of the Dharma. And then, of course, as we know, the rupas are a very modern rep of the Buddha. They, in the Buddha's time, people didn't have rupas. The Buddha, after he died, was represented by a begging bowl. And another way he was represented was by footsteps, just 2 footsteps. The symbolism of the Buddha stepping out into the world. And as we know, the Buddha walked all over India to give his teaching. So it just seemed fitting to come to steps. You know, what were we going to call these 8 things? So we called it 8 steps. We really kind of pained over whether we should put mindfulness in the title. But in a way, if we'd put mindfulness in it, it would be because we were trying to sell the book. And in a way, it wouldn't be truthful, because what we've done is put the Buddhism back into mindfulness. Those of you who are very familiar with mindfulness, is we're seeing that mindfulness is becoming secularized. Not everywhere, but it's like wanting to actually divorce itself from Buddhism, divorce the fact that even mindfulness roots are in Buddhism. And what we could see is that mindfulness is brilliant, and I don't want to knock mindfulness, because mindfulness has great benefits and is doing great stuff out there in the world. But what we're saying is there's more than mindfulness that you need to maintain sobriety of mind, to help with stress, to help with depression. And when you look at the Buddhist teachings, then you will see what else there is. And what you can see happening at the moment, the work of Paul Gilbert, who's bringing in kindness and compassion therapies. Again, coming from the Buddhist teachings. So that's how we came to name the book. So the eight steps. Step one, accepting that this human life will bring suffering. Step two, seeing how we can create extra suffering in our lives. Step three, embracing impermanence to show us that our suffering can end. Step four, being willing to step onto the path of recovery and discover freedom. Step five, transforming our actions, speech, and livelihood. Step six, placing positive values at the center of our lives. Step seven, making every effort to stay on the path of recovery. Step eight, helping others by sharing the benefits we have gained. So those are the eight steps, and I won't say any more. You can ask me some questions. Can you say that a bit louder for me, please?
Yes, sorry, what about regarding that what you've done around for others?
One more time.
Sorry, what about repairing that what you've done wrong to others?
That's in, thank you, so the moral and fearless inventory. So that comes in step four, where we actually look at the precepts, we look at the practice of confession, so how it's important to actually name your actions and to confess it to another person. And looking at the plan, one of the things is that those people who have addictions, or who have in the room here, or people who have lived with people with addictions, know the promise. I promise I'll never do it again. I promise. And 5 minutes later, a month later, they're doing exactly the same thing. And why does that happen? Because often there isn't the plan. So we talk about that, you know, that you know, basically, it's important to become aware of your actions, be important to confess your actions, but all with kindness, and important to look at your plan. What is your plan? If you're not going to repeat that behavior again, what is that plan? And we have a whole reflection exercise on the precept. So it's very much in there. Because I just went on a stream of consciousness, I didn't tell you kind of some of the meat of the steps, so I'm sorry that I was meant to do that, but yeah, that's definitely in there. Thank you.
Have you found that people sort of, because of the 12 steps, I think some people have been put off because there's some point you have to sort of, there's a notion of believing in God in some form, which I've always put some people off, because they immediately think it's religious, but have you found people that you've been sort of presenting with this have related to the fact that sort of Buddhism as a religion is involved in it, if that makes sense?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. The book is new, so we're really, you know, waiting for that feedback, and it's not going to come for a few months. And also, we've been doing the tour at Buddhist centres, so the majority of people have actually been Buddhist. But, you know, we have had 12 people from 12 steps who actually, somebody said to me, they got into an argument with somebody in their cooler group about 12 steps, but they still came along, and she said, and they bought a book at the end of the talk. So, you know, I think this book isn't going to be for everybody. The fact that it's got Buddhism on, the word Buddha, some people might not even pick it up. You know? We have tried to say using the Buddha's teachings, because you don't have to be Buddhist to use it. And, you know, if people open that book, they'll actually see that what we're looking at is really how the mind works. You know, we're looking at that and looking at Dharma teachings to help us with our minds. You know, at the end of the day, if you're somebody with addictions and there's a part of you that doesn't want recovery, you'll find something. You will find something. So people will find some issue with this book, because that's just the nature of the human mind. You know, we talk about going for refuge, and in the book we do talk about placing the Dharma, the Buddha and the Sangha at the center of one's lives. And we use that as an example. And we're saying, well, you know, obviously, you know, you might not be Buddhist, but it's important to find positive values to put at the center of your lives. It's important to have a community of people. So Sangha is a community. You have a community of like-minded people who are in recovery, who do have abstinence to help you maintain your recovery. So that might really put people off. I mean, even with confessions, we were very clear we didn't want to take that out. You know, we had a scholar, Vishwabhani, who was great, who took us through the motions and, you know, can you say this? And he flagged up, do you want to put, confession might put people off. And it was like, yes, we do want to put it in. So we're going to find a way to put it in. So, you know, it may put people off. But, you know, I feel, you know, if the book helps one person, then we've done our job. And I think the book, from what I've heard, has already helped more than one person. And to say, in terms of using, how we'd like to see the book used is, well, you know, as an author, if any of you here are writers, you know, you write a book and it's like giving birth. You put it out there in the world and you have absolutely no control what can happen to that book. Obviously, you know, we have a vision, and a part of that vision is I hope that Buddhist centres will actually open up the doors and actually do a bit of engaged Buddhism and actually introduce a regular dropping evening around recovery and work through the book. I think, you know, it's we get benefit from it. My team love it. My team say, this is what we've been wanting. This is what we've been wanting. We've wanted to be able to do something which means more than just doing it for ourselves. So, you know, there's a benefit for us doing that. As Bhante says, and I think in his book on wisdom and words, that, you know, when we help others, we help ourselves, and when we help ourselves, we help others. But also, we hope that people who aren't Buddhist perhaps will set up groups. You know, Meetup is really big. Set up groups and work in a group with the book. So you don't have to be Buddhist. This book isn't for Buddhists, but because both Paramabandhu and I are part of the Triratna order, then, you know, we're going to say, hey, you know, here's the invitation, use the book. You know, we've done it, this is a gift, use it. But I think it would be absolutely brilliant, people who aren't Buddhists who take the initiative to use the book and perhaps use it in a similar way to the way the big book is used in the 12-step fellowship. Some people might choose to just read the book on their own. You know, so that's the vision for the book. One more question, as time is ticking on here.
Do you envisage the book or the program, if you want to call it that, being used in prison, similar to the Vipassana program that's been used in prison?
Very much. I mean, very much so. Prison is one of the places that it could be used, because prison doesn't have that policy, you can't name religion. You know, in the National Health Service, I think that's why mindfulness has been so successful. If you'd had Buddha, you wouldn't be able to take Buddhism into the National Health Service. As we know, Christians have been charged for praying with people, you know? So there is that policy But in prisons, we know that we can use the Buddhism and take it in, because we have, you know, Buddhist order members who go in. So very much so, this is a book that could be used in prisons. And I know my Detox Your Heart is a book that's been used in prison, because I've had people who have written to me from prison. So very much so. Okay, so, you know, the books need to be sold. Not everybody can have a book, because there just isn't enough. But I know if we sell them all, that Nottingham will get more books in. But spread the word. We do have a website called thebuddhistcenter.com/8steps. And on that website, we've got 21 free meditations for recovery. So, you know, I should be careful what I'm saying, because I'm being recorded here. But we got the idea from Deepak Chopra, who does, you know, the 20-day meditation challenge. So we have done 21 meditations for people in recovery. They're completely free. So it's the first posting. Download them. Use them how you wish. And everybody who put that package together did it because from the place of helping suffering beings, which is just very beautiful. Nobody was paid for it. Even Thich Nhat Hanh allowed us to use one of his verses for it. So do download them. Thank you.
Thank you.